prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver, 1-800-375-4188. For all your gold and silver coin needs, give Melody Cederstrom a call. She's not with me today on this program. Tuesday is Roger Sales calling in, mi compadre calling in from Argentina. Roger, I presume, is here, and we'll find out in a moment, make sure about that, but Melody's not here, but she is back there at the office. And if you'd like to order some gold coins, give her a call. 1-800-375-4188. Before we get to Roger Sales, here's the market reports. Gold is up $19.10 today to $1,613.70 per ounce. Silver's up 37 cents to $29.46 per ounce. Platinum is up $14 to $1,627 per ounce. Palladium is up $11 to $750 an ounce. Let me scroll down here. Dow Jones is up 120 points to 13,904. NASDAQ is up 15 points to 3,132. New York Stock Exchange is up 37 points to 8,756. U.S. dollar is up 0.01. That's a triviality. It might even be falling some today before the markets close. But it's up, but it's currently at 81.87. We've told you previously that they seem determined to hold the U.S. dollar index about 80. It goes up a few points, it goes down a few points, but 80 for the moment appears to be the mark that the powers that be have declared is going to remain the U.S. dollar index, preferred mark, the mark du jour. That if that's true, we can expect the U.S. dollar index to fall about another 2 points over the course of the next week or two. If it does, that should be, not necessarily, but it should be good for the price of gold. Finally, crude oil is off 49 cents a barrel to $92.62 per barrel. So, Roger, are you there?
Right here, Al, and we're going to try an experiment today on the strength of this new G4 wireless thingy I've got in my apartment, and I complained enough yesterday where I think they tweaked something and got it working good, and it sounds pretty good, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sounds fine, but don't give me any G4 stuff because I know you're an old guy and you can't possibly understand what that means. All right?
All
if you were 8 or 10 years old, I'd listen to you. I'd say, yeah, you must know something about G4, but I don't know about senior citizens. I don't think you can. Don't think you can really understand that.
You got to be young at heart, buddy, and you got to keep.
All right, you got to be young at heart.
Stuff.
Listen, I'm not worried about the young at
heart.
I'm not worried about the young at heart.
You're not. You're worried about the old part.
No, I'm worried about the balding part. I'm worried about the balding part. I'm not worried about the young at heart. I don't think anybody gets to be more than 30 years old in their heart. You understand that? But in their body, in their body, that makes a difference. That's where the aging takes place.
You know, there's an old postulate that the older you are on the top of your head, the younger you are at heart. So I'm moving in that direction.
Well, that's a nice theory, but, you know, they have all kinds of – it's like I was talking to somebody on the radio program a week or so ago, and he's 70 years old. He doesn't sound it. I don't know the man personally, but he was a good guy. And he's 70. He says, that's the new 50. And I'm going to be 68 here. I'm going to be 68 in a couple of months. And I told him, yeah, that's the new 35. He's 70 at the new 50, and at 68, I will be the new 35. So what do we got today, Roger?
I don't know, but can you remember when I was in college and that, you know, in the 60s, it was don't trust anybody over 30. You remember that?
Yeah, don't trust anyone over 30.
Heck, I don't trust anybody under 30 now. So anyway, what was your question there, Al?
I didn't have a question, but when it comes to trusting people.
Hang on just a second.
When it comes to trusting people, the Bible says trust no man. And it doesn't make and it does not discriminate as to age.
That is sage advice right there.
Yeah, it might be. It may actually be. It's the sort of thing they say, don't trust anybody over 30. You say, don't trust anybody under 30. Bible says, don't trust anybody. Verse in the Bible says, hey, you know, watch your step.
That's probably the definitive answer right there.
It may be.
The hard way. A hard way once or twice. You know, let me pull this knife out of my back here.
Yeah, I understand.
I noticed from your opening soliloquy there that, you know, it's hard to keep a good metal down, buddy.
That's true. See, I told you didn't have to cry, did you? Gold fell $40 and everybody was weeping and all the world was coming to an end. Gold jumped almost $20 today. And it's jumped a couple days since then. We've regained pretty much of whatever was lost. And, you know, long-term trend has to be up, up, up. There is no other solution.
Without a doubt. I look at these things through jaundiced eyes of a sort because, you know, I've trained my mind for so many years to try and think like our enemy. So when I watch their moves, I try and put myself in their position. And that little move last week, when all of the other things, indicators were so negative, is a sure sign of desperation because all they're doing is nailing their coffin shut tighter. When you start in a very small market like gold and silver, and you start manipulating it to these extents, and the big leveler here has been the internet. People are aware of the banking scam, and whether it's the large-time investors or not, a bunch of smaller people are hitting those markets, and every time that they knock the price down, those people aren't fooled anymore. Now, I don't know if they've got any cash left or not, all right, but the ones that have, you know, several brain cells to rub together are bellying right up to the bar and backing the truck up.
To take as much gold and silver as they can lay hands on.
You better believe it, buddy.
Yeah, but the problem with this is whose gold and silver are they buying? That's one question, and who are the buyers? You know, if we have constructed, or if the powers that be have constructed a system where they are essentially looting whatever might be left at Fort Knox, if there's anything even there, and whatever the remains of America's gold supply, in order to shore up the illusion that the fiat dollar has some value, they are selling the American people's gold and enriching foreign nations like China, for example. I mean, this is... the rumors, we don't know what the truth of the matter is, but it does appear that they are selling the public's gold in order to hold the price of gold down. They're giving it our gold away at fire sale prices. If it were true, we don't know yet that they're sold the gold or any part of the gold at Fort Knox. We don't know that, but the rumors are, you know, they're circling. There are a flurry of rumors in support of that theory. That doesn't make it so, but there are a bunch of rumors. Fort Knox hasn't been audited since 1953. 60 years since anybody's taken a peek in there.
Not a legit audit, even.
I understand.
Then, of course.
I understand.
Now, you know, what I hearken to here is a guy that used to sit on this microphone right here. It was the late and great Bob Chapman. And I've listened to Bob way before anybody used to even know who he was, back on shortwave with Tom Valentine, okay, years ago. And I remember him saying, before I left to move down here, so it had to be at least 5-6 years ago, that his sources in London said that melt bars were showing up there. And
what do you mean by melt bars?
Well, I'm going to go into that for just a second. And the only way that they were there is when they confiscated the gold in the banks in 1933, and those coins are alloys. They use a little bit of copper, nickel, or something to harden them a little bit, because pure gold, like the gold buffalo was a couple of years, is very soft and malleable. And that rather than go back and refine that alloy out, they just melted those 33 St. Gaudens they seized in the bank. And that those are the melt bars, and that's the only way they could really come up with melt bars that were showing up, I guess, at the LBMA, the London Bullion Metals Association, I think. I don't remember that specifically, but I remember him saying that his sources said they were showing up over there, and that was a long time ago. And my thinking, and I think Bob's was at that point also, that if they're getting rid of those bars, they're right down at the bottom of the barrel.
Well, if they were, I don't know if they're down at the bottom of the barrel until, yeah, I guess I get what you're saying. You're saying because those bars had to be 1933, from 1933 or pre-1933 U.S. coins, those bars had to ultimately, they were first melted and they were sequestered within the United States Treasury. And if those bars with that alloy content were on the market, that means someone was selling the Treasury gold. I don't know if you followed this. You probably have. The number of tons of gold that's allegedly owned by the United States has held steady at 8,132 tons. 8,000, I think 132 tons, but some specific number, over 8,000 tons, and it's been there, I don't know, I'll bet you since probably 1970. For 40 years, according to the government, they haven't sold any gold, they haven't bought any gold. They've just set on exactly 8,132, although the 132, I may not be remembering that part clearly. You see my point? Why hasn't the government participated in the market, the gold market, for 40 years? Why wouldn't they sell gold if gold was a loser? Why wouldn't they buy more gold if gold was a winner? Why did they hold at just that point?
Well, you know, this brings up a really interesting point of discussion, Al, and that's to understand what these guys do. You know, we talk about law a lot on here, certainly, mm-hmm. and a lot of the audience is very interested in that. You and I kind of have that background, known for that sort of thing. And we talk about the financial and the monetary system. But, you know, the one thing we don't talk about too much that is so integral and I find is such an absolute necessary piece in all their schemes is the bookkeeping. Now, you talk about this amount of gold on the Treasury balance sheets, but what they've been able to do, you see, through bookkeeping, is they didn't sell it. They leased it. And in leasing it, mm-hmm. when they leased it to a bullion bank, they didn't sell it, so that amount stayed on their books. But then the amount magically appeared over on the bullion bank's books, and it leased out.
Which effectively doubled. Instead of having one bar of gold, they effectively, the reports indicated that there were two.
That's right. And then they lease that out through the bullion bank. So that may be what a lot of us have purchased over the years, are some of those coins, okay, that are still being carried on the book with this bookkeeping magic. You know, it's exactly like, and we've gone into this on your program a couple of times, the information from Tom Schaff, the certified public accountant who was certified as an expert witness in accounting. And he's the one that the bank regulator at his school said every loan in America is a fraud, and he showed him how they're doing the whole monetary scheme didn't even become possible until the 1500s when double-entry bookkeeping came in through the Italy and the Medici's and that area over there, and that allowed them to take a promissory note, the Babylonian legal concept, and plop it down as a liability on one side of the books. Then, because of that legal philosophy, to discount it into the secondary market, sell it, bring back the proceeds, and put them on the asset side of the ledger, balancing the books. There's another accounting trick. The whole blasted world economy is built on it.
That is an extraordinary accounting trick, and it's something that's disturbed me. I took a little accounting once upon a time in college, and I was never able to make sense of this double-entry bookkeeping system. I mean, I recognize it's there. I knew everybody was doing it, and there was something about it that just never rang true to me. I couldn't grasp it on one level, and it's bothered me for years, and over time I've come to understand, as you're explaining, and you probably get this better than I do, that this is essential to the fraud.
It's
we can treat something.
Bedrock.
Yeah,
it's a
very difficult thing for the average person, I suspect, to understand. You talk about accounting. Accounting is essential to a fundamental fraud that's taking place in the world? I'm sure the average person has to hear that and say, oh, that's crazy talk. We keep our books. We run a business. We understand double entry accounting. It makes perfect sense. There's logic behind it and the rest of that. And maybe not. Well, there's logic behind it, but maybe not the logic people imagine.
Well, here's another example from just a couple of years ago when they did the right after 2008, and they were having so much problems with all the bogus paper, carrying all of that fraudulent mortgages, and they just went back and they changed it from mark to mark. And what does that mean? We just take this over here that's valued at this, and we're going to value it at whatever we say it is. Boom. Yeah. Hey, we're solvent.
Yeah, I understand. And the implication on all of this, if we can't even rely, if there are questions about how much gold is in Fort Knox, if there are questions about the fundamental purpose of a double-entry bookkeeping, if there are questions about whether we can continue with a fiat currency, what does that imply for people? What's that tell us about the economy we live in?
You know, I question about the world we live in and how people are so ambivalent to this. And you try and say, don't you see the import of this, just like you're talking about here. And they're just ambivalent. It's just, oh, well, so what? Huh? You know, it doesn't bother me. Well, it's going to affect
still
you
works.
At some point.
Yeah, but it's one of these things that it works. At least it seems to for right now. It's like taking fiat dollars and trying to communicate to someone that it's not real money. You understand? And the average person is going to look at you and like you are out of your mind, or you're speaking in tongues or something, and essentially say, what are you talking about? It spends. I go to the store and I buy myself a new TV, a new computer, a new car. It spends. What do I care about whether it's paper, gold, or anything else? It's a very difficult concept to communicate.
The comment that I got back a couple of times was just what you said in a little phrased a little differently. It says, well, it buys things. Yeah. I said, well, just wait and see how many less things it buys.
Well, it's the truth of the matter is, in my opinion, it doesn't buy things. All right. It merely purchases things, and people
Correct.
Get equitable title by virtue of using a fiat currency. They get equitable title to what they purchase, but they don't get legal title. They don't really own their stuff. And that is a very difficult theory to understand. It's difficult to communicate, and yet it appears to me to be true. We're going to take a break for some commercial announcements. I'm here with Roger Sales, the author of From Sovereign to Serfs. We will be back in a moment on Financial Survival. Please stay tuned.
Denied internet access for their people during civil strife. The FCC seized in-use commercial shortwave frequencies right after the September 11th attacks. No one communication system can be depended on to be there when you need information. You need choices. You need a Ku-band free-to-air satellite system from AVR. The AVR system includes a receiver, an LNB, and a 75-centimeter dish. All you need to get on your own is the coaxial cable. The system is delivered to your door for $149.99. That's right, delivered for $149.99. That's the shipping and the system, $149.99. Call 541-225-4659. That's 541-225-4659. Or visit AmericanVoiceRadio.com and click Satellite System.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here with Roger Sales, my homie from down there on the mean streets of what's the name of the town you're living in down there in Argentina right now?
San Rafael Mendoza.
Do you ever count how many of those trills you got to put on to actually say Rafael? I mean, is it three or four or ten? How many trills do you put on that R?
I don't know that the number's important. You just got to get a couple in there.
It's a subjective thing, kind of, huh?
I had that happen to me in Buenos Aires at the bus station one day. And this was a couple of years ago, and I was trying to change a ticket. And I kept saying, I need to go to San Rafael. And the guy'd go, what? Where? And finally, his supervisor comes out the back, and he speaks a little English. And I said, I want to go to San Rafael. He says, oh, no, you want to go to San Rafael. That's why I do that. We had a big laugh about it. It was before the first Obama election, and they kept saying, do you like Obama? Do you like Obama? And I'm in this gigantic bus station in Buenos Aires. It has 150 bus bays in it. Okay, it's huge, and this country runs on buses. And man, we were laughing like crazy. It was just funny. So anyway, I wanted to get back to what you were saying in the end of the last segment there about this property thing, because you know, as we get deeper into this and you get a little longer in the tooth, you lose a little bit more hair and you get a little bit more understanding. And I easily see now, and I remember this argument years ago, and I couldn't differentiate it years ago, but I see it clear now, and that is they had to do it like this because you're their property, and property can't own property. That's why you only get a certificate of title, and you use these promissory notes to, like you say, you're not buying anything. You're not getting equitable title. You're getting this certificate of title stuff.
Well, and it's the I think the certificate of title divides it up where you get equitable title, which is the right to use and possess a piece of property.
Right.
But the government is keeping legal title, which is true ownership. They have real control. When I think in terms of an automobile, this is part of the reason they can give you a ticket if you haven't fastened a seatbelt.
Yes.
It's because it's their car.
Well,
you
don't
own it. You just think you own the car because I get to drive it. Ooh, I got a car. Yeah, you get to drive it. You get to drive it in the same sense that a cabbie gets to drive the cab or the chauffeur gets to drive the limousine. But you don't own the cab. You don't own the limousine. You just get to use it.
If you're going to go around your house and do a real in-depth inventory, you know, like people used to do, maybe still do, and you copy everything down and you give it a number, don't you?
Yeah.
It's just like a license.
Might. Yeah, I get what you're saying. You're making an inventory and you're identifying item number so-and-so. You may code it for the date you bought it, who knows, but you'll have a lot of people.
Some years ago, I had a very dear friend who was lucky enough to get stationed in Germany with the AFIS, Armed Forces Exchange Service. They're out of Dallas for 5 years. And in that capacity, he could bring back a German spec, U.S. spec car with no taxes. And he bought me a BMW over there. This was in the 80s and brought it back. I saved a bunch of money on it. And but when I got it, went down to Jacksonville and picked it up. Because I had to send the money over there and pay for it out front, when I picked up the car, I got the certificate of title, and I've still got it. The origin.
Did you get the certificate of title, or did you get the title?
Well, what you get is the manufacturer's statement of origin.
That's exactly right. That's not the certificate of title. Certificate of title is what you will get after you surrender the manufacturer's statement of origin. That's the true title. You surrender it to your local state government, and then they send you a certificate of title. And the average person listening to this discussion is probably going to think, that's crazy talk. I got title of the car. I got the certificate of title. That's the title, right? No. Listen to the words. A title is a title.
A certificate
that certifies, a document that certifies that a title exists. A certificate of title is not the title. It's just all the average person has. And that would be true for 99.99% or more of the people in this country who think they own an automobile. You just got a certificate of title. You don't have title. And the reason this is important is because all rights flow from title. If you have the title to a particular car, you can drive it, you can use it, you can rent it. If you have the title, if you have a certificate of title, entirely different situation. Your rights are much less when you have a certificate of title than they are when you have the true title. And it's a difficult concept for people to grasp, but it goes to the heart of what's happening in this country. Again, it's why they can stop you. Here's a ticket. You don't have your seatbelt fastened. Here's a ticket. You don't have insurance. What difference does it make to them? How do they make you do those things? And the answer is you are driving their car.
Absolutely.
They get to set the rules. It's their car. They have tricked you because you don't understand the concept of title. You think you own your car, and they know their thing. No, you don't. You're just like some kid driving her dad's car. Dad will tell you the car, you can only use it up to 10 o'clock tonight. It better not have any cigarette butts in the ashtray. There better be a full tank of gas and no scratches in the paint. And if there's a problem, you're back to riding your bicycle. Dad can do that because, relatively speaking, Dad owns the car as compared to the teenage boy. You get my point on that, Roger.
Dad, I didn't leave that roach in the ashtray. That was somebody else.
Yeah, right.
I wanted to bring up a point that's been on my mind, though, because I've been, you know, contemplating this stuff as we learn and understand more. And I'm pretty sure, and in fact, I'm virtually positive that I could take that documentation that I filed with the State Department, my affidavit reprinted in the back of the book, and my passport, and come back to the U.S. and go in and get a state-issued non-resident driver's license. Ah, now, all of those traffic laws are written for residents, and most people have a resident driver's license. So not only do they own your car, but they also own you. And they can dictate with those regulations what it is that they want you to do, seatbelts or whatever else. So now the question I'm considering, Al, and I've been mulling this over, we haven't talked about it, is if I were to come do that and get a non-residence driver's license, state issued, driving the state's car, would those laws still apply to me because the laws are written for residents?
I get what you're saying, but I would be much amazed if you could find a state that would issue even one non-resident driver's license, unless you were by foreign. If you were a foreign ambassador,
Something along those lines. The regs are right in there. I've seen them in Texas and Oklahoma, and this, all of the traffic laws are uniform, which means that they are the same in all 50 states. And it's very interesting on the requirements. Whatever your state is, has this in the traffic code somewhere. They allow for non-resident driver's license. And you have to have proof that you're a national, and you have to have proof that your parents were nationals. And you see that second prong there is the hereditament prong. You understand what I'm saying?
How do you prove my parents are dead, for example? How do I prove?
Were they born in the U.S.?
Yeah.
I mean, okay. Well, then there's your proof. Okay. So there's the hereditament line that necessitates you being able to claim that political status, and it's in the traffic regulations. You can check in there in your state, okay? That's just, like I said, something that I'm pondering lately.
Well, I get it. It's something to ponder. I mean, if there were a way to get a non-resident driver's license, if I thought that was something that could be achieved, I guarantee it'd be something I'd be interested in.
Well, I guarantee you.
It's the first time I've ever heard of such a thing.
Well, you know, the reason that I know that it's possible is because of the experience I had getting my first passport when I had to go get that state-issued ID. Okay, it was the driver's license division, just another clerk in the same exact cubicle, one down. And when she says, are you a resident? Nope. Are you a citizen of the United States? No. And she's taking my affidavit that I handed her when I walked up and scanning it in page by page, all five pages, while she's asking me the questions. And at the end, she goes, okay, Mr. Sales, that'll be $4. Step over there and get your picture taken. Boom. A Florida state-issued hologram ID as a non-resident, non-citizen of the United States. And I guarantee you'd do the same thing with a driver's license.
Well,
that was a seminal moment for me, Al, because right then was the first time in over 15 years, and I was pretty familiar with most of this formula at that point, and it was the very first time. It was like you hit me upside the head with a sledgehammer. I said, I'll be damned. The whole thing is voluntary.
Yeah, that's the one thing that comes out. You fool around with this long enough, and it seems an inevitable conclusion that you have to volunteer to be subject to the government in a way that most of us would prefer not to be. They operate on the presumption that you know what you're doing. You signed a piece of paper. You said, yes, I'm a resident. Yes, I'm a citizen. Of course I'm a citizen, you know. The average person, how would you deny that? People would be afraid to deny citizenship today, Roger. We've got a situation where you deny citizenship and you can't help but wonder in the back of your mind if they're not going to deposit you down in the slums of Mexico City and say, good luck, fella.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up because I sense people are very scared to do this, and I that's not any kind of a slant because I was too before I stepped through the imaginary barrier of fear. You know, fantasized experiences appearing real, those things you step through that scared you before, and you go, well, why the heck was I scared of that? And now I can look back on the other side of that wall and think this through a little more logically. Well, you know, if you wanted to expatriate instead of repatriate, if you wanted to expatriate and get a French passport, French citizenship. Well, I don't know why the heck you'd want to do that, but you might. And, you know, you got a very formal procedure. You have to set up an appointment with this guy at the embassy in the country. And it's used to be a couple of hours. Now it's a month away. You pay $450. It used to be about $40. And, you know, they make you jump through all these hoops, but they don't go throw you in jail because you want to change over to another country. And here you're just changing statuses to the other status within your own country that you're entitled to it. If both your parents parents were natural born Americans. That's your heritage. That's your hereditament. And that's your right to do that if you want to. And they can't say boo about it. That's why they had to put it like that in the passport application.
Well, we live in a society where increasingly it's not clear what they can or cannot say boo about. The government is operating on the presumption they can say boo about anything.
Well, they can as long as
and
you're
we have
property.
To wonder, and the people wonder. You know, maybe you got to keep your mouth shut. And people are afraid, and the only chance we have is to speak out.
And you see that it draws the masterfulness of this plan. Okay, and as you're able to put these little bitty pieces together and start thinking like they do and see what they've done and see how this has been accomplished, man, let me tell you what, this thing's brilliant, buddy. It is absolutely, no mortal man's mind could have come up with this.
This looks diabolical.
I've had for many, many years. It is diabolical to the heart.
Yeah. You get into it, again, it's not just hard to understand. It's hard to believe. Even if someone like yourself or me could sit down and talk to someone and explain these ideas and produce the evidence and take 2 or 3 days, sit down and talk with one man, one woman, and say, look, here's what's happening. Here's why. You get to the end of the 2 or 3 days, and even if you've managed to communicate all of this clearly to whoever you're looking to, you're talking to, they're still going to find it hard to believe. I said, well, yeah, I understand what you're saying, but I just can't believe this is true.
I think that, and I think about this stuff a lot, Al, is if you want to use the analogy, you're looking at the onion, okay, and you're going, well, I've been studying this onion for 10 years, man, and I know every little crevice on the outside, and I understand how this is all fit together. And somebody comes along like you and I, and they go, well, hold it. This onion that you're looking at, this outside here, that's not where it is, man. You've been lied to out here. It's all the way down here, 6 or 7 more levels deep, right in the heart of this onion. And you've got to cast all that aside. And the problem with that is this. You've got to go back and rethink everything. I mean, listen, when I tell you, and I'm sincere, 20 years into this of eat, sleeping, and drinking it, and dreaming it at night, and I still come to new understandings that I've never had before 20 years into it. So don't think that this is going to be like you're going to read that book or you're going to sit through that seminar and this is all going to be crystal clear to you, because it's not.
No. No, this is like finding a new dimension. You know, people talk about traveling to another dimension, and we see it on, you know, science fiction movies and Rod Serling and do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. And you watch it on the movies and it's all kind of fun and interesting. You can almost do that intellectually. You get into real study of what's happening with the government and the law, and you do this in great depth over a significant period of time. You wind up beginning to realize, holy cow! I mean, it really is, in many regards, like another dimension. It's not, but it's like that. It is so.
It's
almost astonishing. You say you can't fool all the people. You can fool some of the people some of the time, and you can fool some of the people all the time, and all of the people some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time. Well, the truth of the matter is this system has come very, very close to fooling all of the people all of the time, and it is something to behold. You see it, and you begin to comprehend the ignorance and the ideas people believe in that simply aren't so. And it's at times breathtaking.
They use people's instinct, herd instinct, so well. And, you know, that's the thing about this information, and we've touched on this before, Al, is that when it touches the right person, what happens is, I think, is you start thinking again. For one thing is you start bringing that subconscious and your conscious working together again, and you have to start thinking again, where in the past, through the programming, the very sophisticated psychological programming they've been doing for decades, all you did was mostly react.
Yep.
You were like Pavlov's dog. They rang that bell and you salivated. And now,
because here comes the free lunch. Here comes the free lunch. Ring the bell. It's time for the free lunch. Oh boy.
With the hook.
Oh boy.
With the hook.
With the hook. We don't know about it. We don't talk about the hook.
No, they don't ever talk about the hook. But all of a sudden, you got to start thinking again. And see, now when you're thinking comes that individual responsibility stuff we talk about, all right? And is a new life, man. I mean, it's a new life. And I love it. I wouldn't go back for the world.
Frank has jumped the gun by 10 seconds.
Frank,
coming out
we're
going to
flog
you. Supposed to start the music before now. I'm Alfred Addis here with Roger Sales on Financial Survival. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned.
Pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in an untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate in those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad-spectrum immune-boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Or take your chances with the bad boys. Call Apothecary Herbs toll-free, 866-229-3663, or online, thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here with Roger Sales, author of From Sovereign to Serfs. Roger's calling from Argentina. I'm calling from Oregon, and you are listening wherever you happen to be right now. Program is brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. Give Melody Cedarstrom a call, 1-800-375-4188. We were talking about the difficulty of communicating some of the ideas that we believe to be true. And Roger was expressing the idea that you start reading some books, for example, and it causes you to think. And I'm not sure if Roger was, on reflection, whether Roger actually means what I understood him to say or not, but I look at it a little differently. I don't believe a book caused me to start thinking. I started thinking when I went through the trauma of a divorce back in 1983. It took trauma. That was the 2x4 that hit me between the eyes and essentially caused me to think. And my opinion over the years is that we don't start to think until something painful has happened in our lives. And then we sit back and say, what the heck was that? And we try to figure things out.
There's a lot of truth to this.
Then you look, though. Then you read the book and you can understand it because you are thinking, but I think the thinking starts with the trauma. I was fat, dumb, and happy until I went through that divorce.
And I would have thought everything you and I are saying right now, I would have dismissed it as so much crapola.
You
go
through the trauma, you start
to think.
No pain, no gain. A lot of truth to that. My own personal story is I had always thought that something was wrong. I just had a sixth sense from when I was in college in the 60s that something was wrong. And it wasn't until 1992. I had a couple other chances, and I didn't take the road. But that one night on July 16th of 1992, when my buddy walked up and said, income tax is illegal, and I, you know, dispelled it and went, oh, sure. And he goes, no, we got a tape. And I said, well, I want to watch it. I'm open-minded. You know, and I think that's a real key thing here is this open-mindedness thing. You know, Al, another cliche, another saying I particularly like is the mind is like a parachute. It only works when it's open.
Yeah.
And it's old. You probably heard that before, but, you know, there's a lot of truth to that.
Having been in the 82nd Airborne back in the day, I understand that even when they're open, sometimes they don't work properly.
Yeah,
there's cigarette balls, and there's all kinds of crazy things that can happen. But for sure, it's got to open. It won't work if it's not open. And even if it is open, maybe yes, maybe no. You know,
heck of a last ride, though.
Yeah, exactly.
You got any callers on the line or anything?
No, I haven't asked for any. If anybody wants to call in, our number is 1-800-596-8191. Again,
you know, there's
1-800-596-8191. You want to talk to me? Talk to Roger? Talk to the audience? Give us a call. I got an article. I've got something here. Get a comment.
There's some blasted much stuff happening. You just can't keep up with it all.
No, I know. And that's another thing. It's like you are surrounded with lies. You are surrounded with misinformation. The market numbers don't mean anything. Plus, even the amount of new information that's true is growing exponentially in terms of new technologies and so on. No one, just as you said, no one can really keep up with what's going on right now. And that being the case, it does not bode well for anyone, good, bad, or indifferent, maintaining some sort of control over the government, over the society, over anything. Insofar as the information is accelerating, increasing faster than we can keep up, who can steer? It's like having, how fast are we going? The speedometer doesn't work anymore. You don't know how fast you're going. You're driving this car. Now you're at a point where you're just hanging on for dear life. Science says you can't go over 30 around this curve to the right. Well, how fast are we going? Does anyone know? How many curves can we take before someone just flat out loses control? It's one of those things that says, to some degree, it inspires fear. And I'm not trying to inspire fear, but this kind of information certainly makes people anxious. What do you do? From my perspective, you've got to do what you can to protect yourself because there may not be a force around that can truly hold the structures, the infrastructures we've all come to depend on. There may not be any force, good or bad, that can really hold it together. Maybe we are headed for disintegration just because information is increasing too rapidly for us to comprehend and assimilate.
I remember I heard a guy in a speech when I was doing some of that MLM stuff. They had some great speakers, you know, in some of those companies and some of the guys that made the big money, you know. And this one guy was talking about, and he used the example that between 1850, I probably don't have the numbers right, but you'll get the concept here. Between 1850 and 1925, everything, all the knowledge in the world doubled. Between 1925 and 1950, 25 years instead of 75, it doubled again. Between 1950 and 1965 or 70, it doubled again. And it's probably doubling now every, heck, it may be even every couple of years or less than that. And
it may be less than a year.
Like you're saying, that's why people have to specialize so much, because you cannot keep up with the rapidity and the new information that's coming at you literally from all sides, especially with the internet and the power of the world at your fingertips.
So how do you decide who to vote for in an election? I can't keep up with the information. You can't keep up. Obama can't keep up. He doesn't really know what's going on. How do we decide who to vote for in an election?
Well, it doesn't matter because they're all rigged anyway.
Well, my point is this. From the politician's perspective, nobody knows what's really going on. So you vote for the man who stands up and exudes the most confidence. He says, I know everything that's going on here. I have a plan. I can comprehend the whole thing. And insofar as we buy that, we buy the biggest liar in the election. An honest man is going to have to admit, I don't know what the heck's going on here.
Well, you saw what happened.
It's only a liar that says he comprehends.
You saw real vividly what happened in the last election to the honest man.
Well, I understand. We've seen it in a number of elections.
Ostracized, marginalized, robbed. You put an adjective out there, and it was done to him.
Yeah, I agree. We got a caller. Victor is on the line. I'm not sure where Victor's calling from. Hello, Victor. Are you there?
I'm in Missouri.
How you doing, Victor?
Hey, Vic. I think I know this guy.
Matter no wet setting hen, and yes, you do, Robert.
Okay, hey, Vic.
I've got a question for both of you, and that is, a while ago, you mentioned that the state owns us and owns the car. I have an article written by Alfred some years ago, and I've had it in my computer for that long, and he says that the non-disclosure of material fact is fraudulent. Now, if the state claims that you are my car, I would ask them immediately, how is it that you claim to own my car? I'm the one that traded my labor for it. And they can't admit that they own it. They won't.
Well, in most instances, I think the way cars are purchased today, the bank owns it because it's collateralized.
Well, right, but I didn't go through a bank. And when man that I bought it from, or a dealer, they'll say that the law, you have to get the certificate of title from the state. And wanting to be a law-abiding citizen, you go ahead and send them and apply for a certificate. And they claim that you gave them
title. They've just buffaloed. Yeah,
right.
It's just like this mortgages thing with the MERS stuff, I guess, probably, Victor, honestly.
Exactly. It's fraud, and fraud vitiates any contractor agreement.
No, but it's not just fraud. It happened because you voluntarily surrendered if you were the first original buyer of the car, not the used car, different situation. First car comes in from Detroit or Japan or wherever it's coming from. You buy the vehicle, and then they charge you $20,000 for the automobile plus tax, title, and licensing. The title and licensing are extra, and in order to get it, you have to surrender the manufacturer's statement of origin to the government of your state. That manufacturer's statement of origin is the title, and you voluntarily gave it to them. And they're saying, we're just doing what you told us. We're taking legal title, and you volunteered. You are presumed to know what you did.
I was reading an article here recently about somebody that wanted a manufacturer's statement of origin on a car in California, and they went through the process, and the state said the only way they'd give it to them is if they were exporting the car.
Yeah. I've heard of people, if they want to buy the car and they want to get the manufacturer's statement of origin, they have to go to another state. For example, I'm in Oregon. I might drive to Idaho, stop in at a dealer and say, boy, I really like that car, and if I had the cash, pay for it. All right? Not take it out on credit and the rest of that. I'd have to have the cash, pay for it, and tell them, look, I'm going back to my home in Oregon, and I'll register back there. Under those circumstances, I've heard stories that they will allegedly allow you to take the manufacturer's statement of origin because you're going back to your home in another state, wherever you allegedly reside. In that way, you can kind of deceive people, allegedly, into giving you that manufacturer's statement of origin. But
deceive. There you go.
Oh, yeah, I understand. I understand deception lays at the heart of this, but there's layers on layers and wheels within wheels, and if you merely complain, I've been deceived, they're going to say, no, you weren't. You volunteered.
It's a darn
excuse in the eyes of the law. You did it. You're responsible. And to some degree, they are correct. They take advantage of our ignorance, but the first order of business is we are ignorant.
Al, after 20 years and seeing some of these things that, that we've come to understand, I still shake my head, man, honestly.
I'm not a very good computer. I've tried to comment on your website or your blog, and it keeps telling me that I'm the wrong guy.
I don't know.
I'm 77 years old, and I've only had a computer for a couple of years, and I haven't learned to use it.
Well, keep plugging at it, Victor. It'll come.
Yeah, and by the time it does, they'll change it again. Every time I get to where I'm halfway caught up a little bit, then they change it. They come out with something new. It's you never stop learning this stuff. That information flow is persistent, continuous.
Be glad you're not trying to learn back in the DOS days.
Well, I don't know. That's anyway, you just have to keep on trying to learn, though. That's one of the points.
For a couple of days or something like that. I'll try again on the computer. That damn thing's full of gremlins.
Yeah, man. Well, they're out there.
Yeah, I understand. They're full of gremlins. The machines are full of gremlins, and our conscious minds are sometimes full of gremlins, too. Hard to keep track of all the gremlins. There's lots of gremlins. Just be glad the gremlins don't vote.
I was going to tell you about this guy, Victor, right here. He bought my book real early on, and we couldn't get the payment straight. We couldn't take it immediately or something. And he'd send me emails every day. Where can I send you an ounce of silver? Where can I send you an ounce of silver? I mean, I said, hold on, Victor. We'll get you, man. It was funny. I love you, Vic. Thanks, man.
And most of the stuff I was at least familiar with, there are details I didn't know. Oh, you're gone.
Vic. No, Vic's the one here that wrote me. He wrote me back, and he said in an email, he said, Roger, I'd have paid you 1,000 times what you charged me for this book.
Well, 100.
No, I wanted 1,000. Thanks,
well,
Vic.
Well, anyway. I'd be willing to pay you 1,000 times also, Roger, but I'll tell you what, the first time will be, 20 years from now, and the second time will be 40 years from now, and we will keep on. I'm doing my times a little different. I'm not talking about multiplication. I'm talking about years.
Buddy, I'm flat not in this for the money. I want this information out there. It needs to be in the public domain, and God's people need to hear it and understand it, and they recognize it, just like Victor.
Yeah. Well, I want to send Roger this article that Alfred wrote. I'll email it to him, and I'm sure that you remember it, Al.
I don't guarantee it. I sometimes can't remember the stuff I
he's
wrote
old.
Days ago.
Victor, he's old, man.
That's it's just I don't try to clog up my hard drive with a bunch of stuff I remember from back in the day. You know? I try to keep as much memory, so the little memory I have, I try to preserve it for, you know, daily use rather than memory. So, but in any case, I see things sometimes that I've written in the past, and I say, hey, that wasn't bad. You know, it's almost amazing. It reminds you of things you've written.
Sure,
reminds you of things you knew.
Sure, guys.
We're down to our last 25 seconds, Roger. Victor, thank you for your call. Roger, give him a quick pitch on where to give you a call.
www.serfs-up.com. That's serfs-up.com and no1040tax.com. And we're going to talk about that one of these weeks, Alfred.
All right, Roger. Thank you for being on the program with me today. Thank all you folks for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with Melody Cedarstrom. In the meantime, may the good Lord bless you, me, Roger, and Frank, the producer. Bye bye.
Ciao, ciao. Hasta luego.
The bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? But still, there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.